How's everybody doing today? Welcome back to another episode of The Banker Next Door. I am your host, Dr. Joe Berquist. We're going to be continuing our review of The Lords of Easy Money today. We're going to be doing part five, which is chapter four, and we're getting through the first section of the book. There's three sections. Each section has six chapters in it, and we're getting through our first section here. And you can see, if you've listened to the first four episodes so far, there is just a tremendous amount of information in this book. For a book that's only a little over 300 pages long, Christopher Leonard just does a great job of just covering a tremendous amount of territory in that period. So with that being said, I'm going to bring in my little PowerPoint guide here, as it were. So let's just do a quick recap of the first three episodes, in case you didn't care, or the first four episodes. If you didn't catch those, I'm going to kind of run through that real quickly now. So our main character, Thomas Hawnig, he basically became what's called a dissenter at the Federal Reserve. The Fed printed more money in 2 years than it did in its first 95 years of existence. Ben Bernanke wanted to move full throttle with what's called the ZIRP, their zero interest rate program, and quantitative easing. Then we took and that was all in chapter one. In chapter two, we took a look more at Tom's childhood, his early career, his experience as a bank examiner. We reviewed the history of central banking in America. And then we also examined kind of the Federal Reserve during the 1970s, and we looked at a lot of the things that they did. In chapter three, we basically took a look at inflation in the 1970s. We examined what an asset bubble is. We looked at the twin cousins of inflation, which are price inflation and asset inflation. Then we looked at Paul Volcker came upon the scene, and we looked at what Paul Volcker did in the late 70s, early 80s. We looked at Tom's experience during this period of time. Then we went back and we kind of re-examined the Fed's record during the 1970s, and we got into what's called cost push versus demand pull inflation. We ended that chapter kind of talking about Tom's the hard lesson that he learned during this period of time. And then we talked about two of the most historic bank failures that have been Penn Square and then Continental Bank, and how Continental Bank really set the stage and was really the first bank considered to be too big to fail. So, and then we looked at kind of examined Paul Volcker's end and then Tom's future. And so we were looking at the years primarily between kind of 1970 to like 1980, 1981, right in that time period. So now we are coming to chapter four. And so the chapter four is called Fed Speak. And where we're going to cover the years we're going to cover today is basically 1991 to 2001. So we pick up here on October 1st, 1991. Tom has now become a sitting member of the FOMC. He's become the president of the Kansas City Federal Reserve Bank. And Tom is basically going now to kind of experience his first meeting at the Federal Reserve's headquarters in Washington, D.C. So I'm going to kind of describe that building for you a little bit to open the chapter here, just so you could kind of get just a feel for like the atmosphere, what it's like to be put in the room there with the FOMC and when they have their board meetings and when they vote and everything. So let's take a look at that. So this was the first time that Tom was chauffeured to the building as a regional bank president and led in through the side entrance to the private elevator. The gravity of that day was driven home by the majesty of his new surroundings. The lobby of the Mariner Eshels building is a cavernous chamber, rising two stories up to a vaulted ceiling. The wide hallway is inlaid with an immaculate checkerboard pattern of black and white marble, with twin staircases leading to the mezzanine level, bordered with white columns extending to the ceiling. Down the hallway was the boardroom, where the FOMC members took their seats around the big table. Alan Greenspan, the legendary Alan Greenspan, sat at the center. And then we get into kind of that. So that kind of sets the stage, or you kind of get a feel for, you know, kind of how majestic, how beautiful that building is there that they go into. Now we're going to talk a little bit about the recession of 1990 and kind of current conditions. And then we're going to get into what they deem the jobless recovery. So, on the committee members, they worried constantly over the economic machinery that underpinned America's power. There was a corrosive layer of weakness beneath the surface. In some ways, the economic weakness was hidden. The economy was growing, and the dark days of Volcker's interest rates hikes and high unemployment were long forgotten. The mid to late 1980s had been a gold rush on Wall Street, characterized by massive borrowing and gluttonous spending. This was the era of junk bond kings, who used cheap debt to buy companies and then merge them with other companies for a profit or break them up for a quick sale. Think, if you ever saw Wall Street, Gordon Gekko, brilliantly played by Michael Douglas, that was all based on, was it a Michael Milken, the bond king? So just sidebar there. So gas prices were high, layoffs were common, and business investment was slow. The economy slipped into a recession in August 1990 that lasted 8 months, ending just a few months before Honig joined the FOMC. The recession itself wasn't that worrisome. It's what happened next that disturbed the Fed. The economy started growing again, but the jobs didn't come back. This broke the basic pattern of economic cycles going back to World War II. Jobs were supposed to disappear during a downturn, but then come back when growth resumed. This time, the unemployment rate kept rising even as the economy grew. It's very much as though an economy which is picking up steam is running against a 50-mile-an-hour headwind, he said. A key problem, Greenspan explained, seemed to be the debt-fueled growth of the 1980s and the bank failures that followed. These remarks were prescient. Greenspan was describing a problem that would repeat itself, intensify, and become a defining feature of American economic life in the 21st century. Cheap debt produced fast growth for a while, but it was followed by an extended crash and a period of weak growth. Business and households weren't spending money because they were still paying off their debts from the 1980s. It was the recessionary equivalent of a bad hangover. The damage was unusually widespread and affected white-collar workers who were once more insulated from layoffs during a downturn. So what everybody needs to understand, too, is that this was a period of time when globalization was really kicking in, and all of America's manufacturing might was leaving. All of our manufacturing jobs were getting sucked out, and were getting sent overseas. This also became a major staple of the 1992 election for George Bush. This was a big reason why George Bush did not win re-election, was because he had promised to help out the middle class. No new taxes. He was going to protect the manufacturing base. None of which he did. Taxes went up. All the manufacturing jobs were leaving at a record pace. And so you had this recovery, but it was a jobless recovery. And we'll get into that more in a second here. So in 1993, a young Princeton economist wrote a paper that outlined the risks posed by this heavy burden of cheap debt. His name was Ben Bernanke. When explaining the 1990 recession, he called the debt problem the overhang. He pointed out that corporate debt had ballooned in the 1980s and left the economic system fragile in 1990, when the economy was shocked by rising gasoline prices during the Gulf War. In essence, even a small shock was enough to push heavily indebted companies to quickly fire workers and abandon expansion plans. When a recession causes a general decline in sales and profits, firms with already high levels of debt and interest burden face a tighter cash flow squeeze, Bernanke wrote. So now we're going to get into, we're still on the jobless recovery. So let's go. So when Tom became a voting member of the FOMC in January of 1992, the economy was still stagnant. This was the beginning of a period that would coin a new phrase, the jobless recovery. Tom could see it playing out in his own district. There were signs of strength with high grain prices and plenty of new home construction, but a continued slump in manufacturing employment was wiping out many of the higher paying jobs in the Midwest. About 1,000 auto workers in Tom's district had recently been laid off. We think our district is growing somewhat more slowly. It might be described as flat at best, Tom said. He would say basically the same thing during almost every meeting in 1992, using words like mixed and sluggish. No models can explain the type of patterns we are having, Greenspan said. This is really a quite extraordinarily difficult type of environment. If the economy had broken with past patterns, then Greenspan was willing for the Fed to do the same thing. He guided the central bank to cut interest rates in the early 1990s, even though the economy was growing, which was the opposite of what the Fed should be doing according to the traditional models. In 1991, the Fed cut the short-term interest rate from a little more than 5% to just under 4% by early 1992, hoping to give the economy some sweet palliative medicine that might counteract the debt overhang. but it quickly became clear that a lot more medicine was going to be necessary. Throughout 1992, the Fed cut rates steadily, meeting after meeting, bringing them all the way down to 2.9% by the end of the year. This emergency measure turned into something like the status quo. The Fed would keep rates around 3% until early 1994. Tom voted yes in line with Greenspan at every single meeting during his first year as a voting member. If Tom was a born dissenter, he was hiding it well. So Greenspan's actions were not a short-term emergency response. They marked the beginning of a new era of easy money. The easing that Greenspan oversaw in 1992 was mild compared to what was to come, and the overhang of bad debt in 1991, which the Fed had helped create, was modest compared to the overhangs it would help create later. Greenspan became a major public figure in those years, maybe the most famous chairman in the history of the Federal Reserve. But even as more people learned who Greenspan was, they seemed to learn less about what he was doing. The 1990s was the decade when the Fed truly moved into the center of economic policymaking, but Greenspan worked very hard to make sure that this truth was obscured. So now we're going to get into Greenspan and basically the Fed's public persona during this time, the things that Greenspan did that were very different from his predecessors in terms of his public image, public speaking. We're going to get into Fed speak here in a minute, which also could have been described as what I knew as green speak. And I'll get into that in a minute here. So let's continue on. So the Fed was created in such a way that its actions would be shielded from the accountability of the voters. But there was still a general sense that the central bank should at least make regular reports to politicians in Congress to explain what it was doing and why. This idea led to a strange ritual during the Greenspan era. The wise chairman, with his dour demeanor and his big frame glasses, would travel from the dignified confines of his office at the Eshels Building down the National Mall to the office of Congress. There, he would sit before the lawmakers and explain the Fed's actions. The hearings were odd because it wasn't at all clear that Congress had any authority over Greenspan. Congress couldn't cut funding to the Fed. It couldn't fire or demote Greenspan. Yet Greenspan permitted himself to sit for the hearings, which were televised on C-SPAN. He tolerated the questions and the long-winded soliloquies of elected lawmakers and then gave his own prepared statement. In these meetings, Greenspan had the air of foreign royalty. He listened politely, he answered questions, and then he left. So it's very important to understand what was just said here. In other words, the Congress does not have, in reality, any power over the Fed. Just like they said, they can't cut their funding. They cannot fire Greenspan. They cannot fire other members. The president can, but members of Congress cannot. So, but you also have to understand, too, that the Fed has changed a lot over the decades. And when you go back to like the Great Depression and you go back to a lot of stuff that happened in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s, you know, the Fed didn't talk to anybody. They didn't talk to Congress. They didn't come out. They didn't have regular press conferences. You heard very little, if nothing, from the Fed. So there was a lot of pressure over the years, especially in the 1970s when things broke out and, you know, Paul Volcker came on the scene and, you know, offered more explanation as to what was going on. So there was this kind of sense that the Fed had to be more, accountable to the people. You know, there was starting to get more heat on the Fed. So the Fed had to come out and create more of a public persona. And Greenspan set the tone for not only himself, but future heads of the Fed to come, in which, you know, they have to come out periodically, do these press conferences, talk to Congress, give their prepared statements, answer questions, and then head on back to the Fed headquarters. So it's just important to kind of understand some of the context there. But now let's keep going here. So of all the people in America, Alan Greenspan was believed to be the one who could best determine and describe the state of the American economy. He was described as an oracle, the maestro who dwelled at the zenith of the economy and had insight into every corner of it. He played this part well. Greenspan wore a dark pinstripe suit, a white shirt, and a maroon tie. He sat alone at a table with a white tablecloth and a microphone. The period of weak growth and rising unemployment in the early 1990s was long gone. The economy grew steadily between 1993 and 1998, with unemployment falling to 4.4% and wages rising steadily. When the lawmakers were done speaking, the financial press would sit up, alert. It was the Oracle's turn to talk. His words could move markets. If he betrayed the slightest hint as to what the Fed might do in the future with a few words about treasury yields or a stray comment about commodity price inflation, Greenspan might signal if the Fed was about to tighten or loosen the money supply. At least this is what the financial press had decided to believe. They scrutinized his every word, searching for patterns that might make headlines and that a bond trader might find useful. The Fed's actions affected every aspect of economic life, albeit with long variable lags, and its policies could spell the difference between prosperity and calamity. He, Alan Greenspan, intentionally spoke in a way that was not just inscrutable, but incomprehensible. This type of speech earned a nickname on Capitol Hill, Fed speak, or as CNBC used to say, Greenspeak. It was a language so studded with jargon and with so many concepts nested within one another that a person needed an economics PhD or many years worth of experience trading on Wall Street to make sense of it. So let's take an example of this. I'm going to read an example here from this for you guys. So let me see if I can pull this off very smoothly. So Greenspan's testimony that day, for example, included this statement. The fact that economic performance strengthened as inflation subsided should not have been surprising, given that risk premiums and economic disincentives to invest in productive capital diminished as product prices became more stable. But the extent to which strong growth and high resource utilization have been joined with low inflation over an extended period is nevertheless extraordinary. Indeed, the broadest measures of price change indicate that the inflation rate moved down further in the first quarter of this year, even as the economy strengthened. So what did we say there? So this was typical. The curious thing about these statements is that they seemed more opaque and difficult to understand than the things that Greenspan said during actual FOMC meetings when he was surrounded by PhD economists. So to be sure, he talked about complex financial systems, but even a layman reading his comments later would understand him. This all changed when Greenspan opened his mouth in public. A cloudy veil drew down over his words. Greenspan's use of Fed speak had a lasting and important impact. It accelerated the long process that removed the politics of money from the center of American public life, just as those politics were becoming more important to the nation's economy. Any average citizen who heard snippets of Greenspan's comments couldn't be blamed if they came to believe that whatever the Fed was doing, it must be so complex that no normal human could dare to talk about it, let alone criticize it. Greenspan's speeches entrenched the image of the Fed as a group of genius-level decision-makers operating on an Olympian plane as they grappled selflessly with hyper-complex matters. And, you know, that is so on the money. That is so on point, because that is exactly what the Fed wanted to do. They wanted to create this mystique. They wanted to take this image that they were, you know, these know-it-all, incredible genius PhDs that were up there. And unfortunately, as we're going to find out as we continue through the rest of this book, that they are anything but that. Painfully, anything but that. But you have to understand this. You have to understand the image first, the image and the context, all the pomp and pageantry, if you will. And once you kind of see through that, you just see them for the human beings that they are, the fallible human beings that they are. You get a much better sense of what's going on and how things work and what came before and what will come after. So continuing on. So there was a tension to this arrangement that bubbled around the edges of the public discourse, even during public congressional hearings. I believe that monetary policy follows fiscal policy, Hinckley, a senator from New York, politely said during his remarks. This comment highlighted an important divide that would soon widen beyond the point of repair. On one side of the divide, there is monetary policy controlled by the Federal Reserve. On the other side, there is fiscal policy, which belongs to the democratically controlled institutions like Congress, the White House, and state governments. Fiscal policy involves the collection of taxes, the spending of public money, and regulation. America's ability to conduct fiscal policy deteriorated slowly over the years as the Fed's ability to conduct monetary policy strengthened. There were many reasons for this fiscal decay: money in politics, the rise of corporate lobbying, the birth of television cable news, and growing income inequality all played a role. But the one important fact about the deterioration of executive and legislative power is that it was not inevitable. For at least a century or so, fiscal policy led the way in America, and the Fed and its money printing power followed. Now, here's a clue here. Why? Let's ask a common sense question. Why would you think that monetary policy would overtake fiscal policy, that monetary policy would kind of take the front seat? Perhaps politics. Perhaps Congress doesn't want to actually do their job. They would much rather the Fed do their job for them and that they basically get a pass. Because when you have to make tough decisions, that may lead to what? You not getting reelected. And it's much easier to pass the buck because what did we just establish? Congress, you know, the Greenspan came down to Congress to make some comments and to speak and testify, if you will, but they have no power over him. They can't fire him. They can't cut the Fed's budget. So they can't really do anything. They can raise Cain. They can make a nice scene. They can get some nice sound clips for cable TV, but they can't really do anything to him at the end of the day. And that's the whole point. The point is, it's like, well, we'll let him take the bullets because nobody can touch him. Nobody can really do anything to him. And we stay safe. The politicians stay safe because we don't take the blame because it was his fault. He did it. So anyway, okay, now let's continue on here where you go into kind of the growing divide between monetary policy and fiscal policy. So the largest burst of fiscal action in U.S. history happened after the Great Depression and the election of Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1932. Over the following decade, Roosevelt and a Congress with huge Democratic majorities passed a set of sweeping and interlocking laws that came to be known collectively as the New Deal. This is important to consider because of the effect it had on the economy and its arrangement of winners and losers. The New Deal laws empowered labor unions, broke up or regulated big monopolies, created the first transparency laws for Wall Street, and put the banking system on a tight leash. The New Deal was confrontational. It antagonized powerful interests, and it took away their power. Literally, the first day after his inauguration, FDR shut down the banks because the banking system was triggering the Great Depression after years of reckless speculation. FDR called this temporary shutdown a bank holiday. And he used the time to send in examiners and determine which banks were solvent and which were not. After that, the government restructured and re-regulated the banks in a way it never did again. The New Deal banking laws were like commandments from the Old Testament. They were short, simple, and sweeping in their reach. The most famous of these laws was called the Glass-Steagall Act, which neatly divided the entire banking industry into two spheres: commercial banking, where customers put deposits in the banks, and investment banking, where the banks speculated in the markets. This kept people's banks' deposits safe. The safety was further enforced by the creation of the FDIC, which created a government-backed insurance program to protect consumer deposits. This gave birth to the world that Tom Hawning inhabited when bank regulators had strong oversight over lending. As FDR antagonized these powerful forces, though, he inevitably got his wish. These forces really did hate him, and their hatred endured. The hatred even intensified during the 1960s when Lyndon Johnson was president. Johnson was a New Deal acolyte, and he expanded the reach of government even further when he passed the Great Society programs like Medicare and Medicaid. Backlash against these programs and the New Deal animated the conservative movement that would gain power with the two-term presidency of Ronald Reagan in the mid-1990s. It fueled the rise of a more radical Republican-controlled Congress under Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich. He personified the anti-government spirit of the New Deal critics, which portrayed their grievance as a defense of the little guy. Okay, I'm going to take a pause there for a second. calling Newt Gingrich and the Republicans of that time radical, that's a joke. I would almost describe them as kind of tame pussycats compared to kind of the battles that rage that we've witnessed here in the last 8 years. But you also got to understand, like, you know, he's basically saying that almost like, you know, these powerful forces didn't really have a gripe or didn't have a reason to kind of rail back against some of these things. And they did. There's two sides to every story. And I think that what Christopher Leonard is presenting there, I think there's a little bias there coming out there. I don't think that that's necessarily fair. You know, there is there's a balance there. I guess I would say there's a little bit more of a balance there. So now let's go. So we're talking here about the lasting effects of the New Deal, and now we're going to get into the Fed as the escape hatch. So the Federal Reserve presented elected politicians with a convenient escape hatch. Oh, wait a minute. Didn't I just mention something about the politicians wanting to be off the hook? It could print money when recessions began and tighten the money supply if inflation became too intense. This method didn't cause nearly as many fights as imposing financial legislation. It seemed like no one had to pay a price for letting the Fed gain more authority and more responsibility. The journalist and economic historian Nicholas Lehman had pointed out that the Fed-centric model follows the theories of John Maynard Keynes, the eminent economist who argued that government should spend money in times of recession to boost growth. Keynesian economic management had no immediate natural enemies, Lehman wrote. Economic management became the art of filling a bathtub with money, increasing the money level when times were tough, and reducing it when inflation looked like a danger. The Fed's primary power was to make money cheaper and more plentiful, and Greenspan used this power generously. In 1989, interest rates had been close to 10%. During the 1990s, they fell to as low as 3% before rising again. Between 1995 and 1998, rates were held at about 5%. This timing happened to coincide with one of Alan Greenspan's more aggressive actions. A series of rate cuts in the late 1990s that fueled a stock market bubble. The rate cuts illustrated that while using the Fed's power might not generate any natural enemies, it did come with very high costs for the American people. So right there you see, I mean, that's kind of the whole point there. The Federal Reserve presented elected politicians with a convenient escape hatch. It could print money when recessions began and tighten the money supply if inflation became more intense. This method didn't cause nearly as many fights as imposing financial legislation. Like I said, you know, it got the politicians loved it because it got them off the hook. So now let's get into political disputes at the Fed during the 1990s. So behind the cloud of Fed speak, there were, in fact, serious political disputes unfolding inside the FOMC during the 1990s. In Paul Volcker's formulation of two inflation cousins, one for consumer prices, the other for asset prices, the Greenspan Fed made the consequential decision over time to focus on only one of them, consumer price inflation. The Fed could keep cutting rates and keep increasing the money supply just as long as the price of consumer goods didn't rise too quickly. The price of assets was left to behave according to its own unruly nature. So let's again stop and ask a common sense question. Why do you think the Fed, and why do you think politicians would like the Fed to focus more on consumer price inflation as opposed to asset price inflation? Because consumer price inflation, that hits the poor in the middle class. Okay, they don't like that. When the poor in the middle class get angry and feel like they're losing ground, they don't have money to eat and pay the rent and everything, they get mad. And when they get mad, they vote politicians out of office. Okay, however, on the other side, asset price inflation is great. Assets go up, the value of your house goes up, the stock market goes up, your investment portfolio goes up. That makes people happy. It makes them feel wealthy. It makes them feel like their assets are increasing in value. When in fact, their assets are not really increasing in value. It's the value of your money is going down, but that's okay. Well, I'll digress off that point for a moment, but let's continue on here. So there doesn't appear to be any single meeting where this policy was officially adopted. It happened over time, and as it solidified, it became an increasingly uneasy fit for Tom. Tom was haunted by the rule of long and variable lags and the experience of watching the FOMC create the great inflation without even realizing it. Rate cuts were often presented as a form of insurance against a future downturn, and that's how the cut of 1995 was being presented. I am concerned that the insurance comes with its own price, Tom said before casting his no vote. He was the only member to vote against the cut. And over the next year or two, it appeared that his analysis had been wrong. The rate cut helped boost growth, and the much-dreaded signs of inflation never arrived. This economic data compounded the sting that Tom felt from voting no. So here's a very important lesson here in this. The lags between interest rates increases and interest rate cuts, they can take years. They could take 2, 3, 4, 5 years for the impact to be fully felt from this. And when you, as we'll see in a second here, when you go against the grain and you say, no, I'm not for this, you can be proven right over time. However, in the short run, in the first year or two, nothing might happen. And that's when you will get jumped on and you will get criticized. And basically everyone will paint you as a fool for being the dissenter. However, over time, as things play out, a totally different narrative may form and you may be proven right. But again, but people are only focused in the short term. So that being said, okay. One of the more delicate lessons that Tom learned during his time on the FOMC was the unwritten lesson about dissent. There was a reason that FOMC votes were wildly lopsided, and it had nothing to do with the Fed's bylaws. On paper, at least, the FOMC was supposed to be a voting body, not unlike the Supreme Court. This might make it seem like there would be close votes on the FOMC, as there were on the High Court, where decisions were sometimes split almost evenly. Just like the Supreme Court, the FOMC was voting on complicated issues with unclear outcomes, but close votes were unheard of. The reason for this was the FOMC's culture and the tradition of deference to the Fed chairman. I will tell you, there were instances where people kind of are surprised that you might vote against the chairman, Tom said. I don't know how to describe it. There is kind of a message that it's, you know, it's very unusual to vote against the chairman. You have to do it with great care. There's not a manual that says you don't vote against the chairman, but there is kind of an uneasiness you see in the room if you're voting against the chairman. So basically, the chairman is he's the king, man. He's the grand poobahs. He's in there, and you know, you better be very careful if you go against him. You know, otherwise you might get on the wrong side there. So, so now we're going to look at the Greenspan's focus on consumer inflation and then how that ultimately led to the stock market bubble. So Greenspan had a solid rationale for focusing only on consumer price inflation. For one thing, it was easier to track. The price of gasoline, bread, and television sets is easy to collect. It was also more politically popular to fight price inflation than asset inflation. Wow. Somebody might have just said that a moment ago. Very few people complained if the Fed took action to bring down the price of consumer goods, but bursting an asset bubble caused immediate pain, and it caused pain especially in the households of the very rich. To raise interest rates in the face of a bubble is almost to pay a certain price to head off an uncertain threat and to incur the wrath of politicians and the public who love nothing better than a soaring market, wrote the financial journalist Sebastian Mallaby. His biography of Greenspan, The Man Who Knew, captured the policy history of Greenspan's Fed in minute detail. It showed that the decision to fight price inflation rather than asset inflation happened gradually, but was unmistakable by the 1990s. This wasn't just a quirk of the Greenspan era, it set a permanent pattern. Greenspan was rewarded for the decision. It helped explain why lawmakers in both parties praised him at the public hearings. They both praised him for this because they loved it. Greenspan appeared to be the most talented financial engineer of his generation. And the key to his success, along with the mystery of it, was that he managed to stimulate the economy without stoking price inflation. Asset inflation, however, was completely out of control by 1998. But this didn't raise much public concern. When asset inflation gets out of hand, people don't call it inflation, they call it a boom. Let me read that again. When asset inflation gets out of hand, people don't call it inflation. They call it a boom. Much of the asset inflation of the late 1990s was showing up in the stock market, where share prices were rising at a level that would have been horrifying if it was expressed in the price of butter or gasoline. The financial press covered the activity in these markets in the way ESPN covered sports, with a short-term, hour-by-hour storytelling that focused on which player was up and which was down. The big star of this performance, the Michael Jordan, was the crop of newly born technology stocks like the web browsing firm Yahoo and newly minted internet retailers like Amazon, eToys, and Value America. What was less prominently discussed was the relationship between these stock prices and the increasing supply of money that the Federal Reserve was pumping into the banking system. By 1998, it was undeniable that the stock market boom was closely tied to the Fed's policies. This is why Tom was worried when he arrived in Washington for the FOMC meeting in mid-November. It was a pivotal moment for the Fed. By cutting rates, it had made money cheaper and encouraged more lending and stock purchases. The Fed could now wait and see how the stimulus worked its way through the system, or it could accelerate the money flow even further, potentially inflating the stock market bubble. So a couple of things there. So you have to remember in the 1990s, this was the rise of CNBC. CNBC was basically the first 24-hour, full, just like ESPN was the first, sports channel. CNN was the first 24-hour news network. CNBC rather was the first 24-hour all business network that just followed the stock market all day long. Everybody watched CNBC, and this was before the, before Fox Business and Bloomberg, and there were other channels and other competition. And they, so they wanted to make it entertaining. They wanted to make it interesting. So they focused on what was hot. So they focused, stocks are hot. Stocks are rolling. Tech stocks, tech stocks are rolling. Microsoft, Oracle, Netscape, all these kind of stocks at the moment. And basically you see the forming of the stock bubble. The stock bubble was just blowing up throughout the 90s and kind of reached its zenith. Around 1998, 1999, as the Fed cut interest rates and pumped, overstimulated the economy, causing this asset price increase. Asset inflation increase. So Fed chairmen usually downplay the impact of low interest rates on the stock market, but Greenspan was blunt about the connection during the November meeting. He acknowledged that the stock market might be a bubble, which made him hesitate about cutting rates even more. But even in the face of this asset bubble, Greenspan pushed for another rate cut. Price inflation wasn't rising, he said. Labor costs were barely rising, and there were reasons to cut rates in November. The biggest worry at the time was the worsening debt crisis in Russia, where the government was unable to pay back its loans and the IMF appeared unwilling to bail it out. This might destabilize foreign markets and the chaos could reach U.S. shores. Cutting rates might help inoculate the financial system against these stresses, he argued. The cost of the insurance is very small, and I suspect it is probably not a bad thing at this stage to take out the insurance, but then to stop at that point, stay on hold, and watch events as they materialize over the weeks and possibly even months ahead, Greenspan said. William Poole, the president of the St. Louis Federal Reserve Bank, said he would go along with a rate cut, but only reluctantly. When it was Tom's turn to speak, he echoed these worries. I think President Poole said it best, that we could be pouring gasoline on this economy. I have concerns that a bubble economy syndrome may be building. However, Paul and Tom voted with Greenspan to cut rates. So they voted with him. They didn't go against him. In an interview with the New York Times, Greg Maffei, the CEO of a fiber optics company called 360 Networks, explained the error succinctly. We had an enormous amount of relatively low-cost capital, Maffei said. When people throw a lot of money at things quickly, sometimes it's not all rational. The FOMC increased rates sharply after that, from 5.7% to 6.5%. This was the equivalent of hitting the emergency brakes on a subway train. This was the equivalent, the traders made a rapid transition in their thinking as they adjusted to a world where costs would be higher for money and for debt. They imposed a new framework on the value of the assets they were buying and selling. One such asset was shares of stock in a San Francisco-based company called Pets.com, which went public in February of 2000. These shares were like those Florida land deals Galbraith had written about. Quite suddenly, the traders started to re-examine the value of the real-world asset that underpinned the paper asset. They saw that Pets.com had failed to think about the high cost of shipping dog food. The company's stock had debuted at $11 a share, but began to fall steadily. This was the signal that the self-reinforcing logic of everlasting asset values was over. And it was over because the Fed was raising rates. Pets.com declared bankruptcy in November. The stock market crash of 2000 wiped out $1.76 trillion of value in 280 internet stocks between March and November. Yes, that was pretty crazy. I remember I lived through all that. It was pretty wild. The Federal Reserve had played a decisive role in creating and then destroying the multi-trillion-dollar stock market bubble. But when the market crashed, bankers, traders, and politicians turned to the Fed for help. The disaster only seemed to enhance Greenspan's reputation as a financial rescue artist. Only the Fed was believed to hold the power to recalibrate markets and avert a larger disaster. This fact revealed a third pillar of Greenspan's policy framework as Fed chairman. He chose to control price inflation, ignore asset inflation, and then step in and bail out the system when asset prices collapsed. This might seem like an odd strategy for a libertarian-leaning thinker who was vocal in his distaste for government intervention. But over the years, Greenspan learned that bailouts were unavoidable. Letting big banks and debt-laden governments fail was simply too painful to consider. This was another policy that developed slowly with the accumulation of many independent decisions. As Sebastian Mallaby wrote in his biography of Greenspan, the Fed had bet its reputation on the proposition that it could clean up after the bubble. If it succeeded in that task, perhaps the downturn would be mild enough for the earlier boom to have been worth it. The cleanup job in 2000 and 2001 was enormous, but the Fed began quickly and forcefully cutting interest rates to 3.5% by August of 2001. Tom was once again a voting member of the FOMC, and he largely supported this action. The Fed was built to offer cheap money during a crisis, and nobody could deny the market crash was a crisis. But the question was how far the Fed should go. This was where Tom started to part ways with Greenspan. In May, Greenspan wanted to cut the interest rate by a full 0.5%, an enormous change. Tom wasn't against easing, but he felt the Fed should move more slowly, given time for its previous rate cuts to take hold. Tom's position was hardly radical. Rather than making a 0.5-point cut, he argued to make a 0.25-point cut. "Mr. Chairman, I think we should pull back on the throttle today," Tom said. "We've added significant liquidity to the market. Now we should let it work through and we should be far more cautious about further moves." Tom lost this argument. His dissent that month was only the second in his career, and he was the only member who voted no. So now we're going to get into, we're going to lead up to basically September 11th here. So on September 11, 2001, terrorists attacked the United States using hijacked airplanes, killing nearly 3,000 people and throwing the economy into chaos. This was an emergency on top of the ongoing economic emergency. The Fed responded with more interest rate cuts to cushion the blow, and nobody complained. But in December, Tom would cast his second dissenting vote of the year. When it was Tom's turn to talk to at the FOMC meeting that month, he once again counseled caution and restraint, worrying about long and variable lags. He pointed out that interest rates had already been cut to 2% from more than 6% just 1 year earlier. "Mr. Chairman, I really think we ought to stay where we are. A 2% Fed funds rate is stimulative," Tom said. "We are seeing some signs of improvement, and not all of that stimulus has come into play yet. While I recognize that inflation is not an immediate issue, and I appreciate that, I still think we need to take a little longer run view at this time." Once again, Tom lost the argument, and he was again the lone dissenter, and the Fed cut rates. Over the next 2 years, the Federal Reserve state of emergency became almost permanent. The rate cuts of 2001 remained in place, with the cost of short-term loans staying below 2% until the middle of 2004. This era became comparable to the era of the 1960s, when monetary policy paved the way to an economic collapse, but this time would be different. Greenspan's policy of controlling price inflation and ignoring asset bubbles would take an extreme form during the 2000s. The Fed would play a pivotally important role in stoking the largest asset bubble, leading to the worst crash since the Great Depression. Once again, Tom was there every step of the way, but this time he played an active role in the process. He rarely expressed regret about his votes on the FOMC, but the era of housing bubble was an exception. Tom helped invite a bubble. So we're going to hear more about that as we get into the next chapter, as we get into chapter 5. A lot happening there at the end there, but we're seeing how these patterns developed here throughout the 90s, and they were stoked by Greenspan. His focus on asset price, his focus on asset price inflation, you know, it, it, um, I'm sorry, his focus on consumer price inflation and just letting asset prices run wild. He basically stoked what became known as the era of bubbles, the bubble era. And, you know, we're going to see that he led to his actions led directly to the stock market bubble bursting. Then they led to the real estate bubble bursting. You know, Greenspan retired in 2006. And we're going to talk a lot more about Greenspan's legacy in the chapters to come. And we'll talk more about it toward the end of the book as well. Because, you know, Greenspan is certainly to blame. I mean, I think his legacy, as we look back, is much different than what was portrayed at the time when he was heralded as, you know, the maestro, the know-it-all, the oracle, you know, this incredible financial engineer. So we'll talk more about that in the next few chapters. But hopefully, if you're liking this series so far, if you're really enjoying this, please make sure to like, share, subscribe. That always helps the channel. And I will be back again real soon for the next chapter here as we continue the journey through the Lords of Easy Money. Thanks a lot, and I will see everybody again real soon.